This is Biochem 422 on Friday, January 8th, I believe.
Correct.
January 8th. And we're continuing on in, and we'll finish chapter 20, which deals, not chapter 20, chapter 19, and go on to 20, which deals with the citric acid cycle and also the citric acid cycle and also electron transport system, how you get energy out of it. I would like to thank everybody for coming today. I'm grateful. Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, thank you so much for keeping us safe in all the snow and help us to have a good day and a great Sabbath to come. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so where were we anyway? Well, if you remember from yesterday, and I know you've reviewed, is that correct? You guys consistently review every day, is that right? I know you do. And you can see here that we're talking about the citric acid cycle, and this particular graph talks about where input and where materials and carbon units enter and carbon units leave. Now, I just want to let you know, and I think we're going to get to it. I hope we get to it. Is the isoleucine, methionine? These are all like this aspartate, tyrosine. These amino acids you see entering here are in fact the carbon backbones. There's no nitrogens on those things when they enter into the citric acid cycle. That's been stripped off in the urea cycle, and so. Don't be confused by going, well, where's the nitrogen on this? Well, it's gone. It's been transferred to a glutamate or glutamine pool, and that pool is then used to provide nitrogens for the urea cycle. And I hope we get to that. Anyway, this is another diagram. This is a written-out list of fates for the intermediates in the citric acid cycle. The title of this slide is Regulation of Citric Acid Metabolism. I'm not sure how regulated it is, but at any rate, that's what it talks about. It actually has on the right a gluconeogenesis actually is shown here. Gluconeogenesis is actually shown here. So, but we'll quickly run through the citric acid cycle. The citrate that's in that can be used as a source of fatty acids, cholesterol. The alpha-ketoglutarate, various amino acids enter and depart from alpha-ketoglutarate. Succinyl-CoA is an important source for porphyrins. We will not be able to go through the porphyrins at all this semester, unfortunately. It's also the entrance for certain amino acids and odd-chain fatty acids. Hopefully we'll get to that. Fumarate, again, more amino acids. Malate and oxaloacetate combined can be used as a source for glucose, and also an entrance for certain amino acids. As these intermediates are drawn off, if they're drawn off, this Krebs cycle can slow down because there's not much of each of those intermediates. Again, if you remember, I talked about the citric acid cycle being a kind of a the entire cycle being a catalytic unit. So there's just microscopic amounts of each of those intermediates present at any given instant. And if they're drawn off, for example, if it's succinyl-CoA is being drawn off for porphyrins, the succinyl part of it, where do you get more from it? Well, you get more, and the key here is, as these intermediates are drawn off, the normal level of the intermediates is restored by pyruvate carboxylase. Pyruvate carboxylase, and if you remember this from last year, or last semester, pyruvate carboxylase is way down here at the very beginning of gluconeogenesis. Now, gluconeogenesis, of course, is a pathway that uses a lot of the enzymes of glycolysis to make glucose from short-chain carbon units. Three or more carbons, typically three, using pyruvate. And so if you would go down this column, you would have glycolysis. To go up this column, you have gluconeogenesis. The enzymes on the left part of this column are the unique ones required for gluconeogenesis. And the one down here at the bottom is the most important in terms of our aspects here, in terms of anapleuretic, because pyruvate carboxylase can take pyruvate, which is a very common structure available to the cell, either from amino acids or from glycolysis, and combine it with using energy from ATP and carbon dioxide to make oxaloacetate. And as soon as oxaloacetate is made, then you can see then if there's plenty of oxaloacetate available, then you can restore the intermediates of the citric acid cycle. So if a molecule of succinate is drawn off here for making hemoglobin, immediately, not one molecule, but if there is a significant number being drawn off for hemoglobin structure formation, then this enzyme kicks in and begins to produce excess oxaloacetate, which combines with acetyl-CoA to restore the balance in the rest of the system. That's kind of how it works. Let's quickly review gluconeogenesis. Again, gluconeogenesis is a very important pathway in the body. If you have not had breakfast this morning, have you guys had breakfast this morning? I know you have. Outstanding. Very good. Anybody here not had breakfast this morning? Come on, you can be. Okay, all right. Well, let me ask you this question. The 20% of your respiration right now, 20% of the oxygen you're breathing is used exclusively in your brain. And right now, prior to starvation, your brain is dependent completely on one sugar for its energy source. And what sugar is that? Glucose. There has to be glucose in the blood or you're going to starve your brain and die or go into a coma. People have been murdered using excess insulin in which they've injected high concentration of insulin into the bloodstream. The body responds appropriately and draws out too much glucose from the bloodstream, fooled by that excess insulin, and people have starved their brain because of excess insulin and using that as a murder weapon. It's difficult to catch because you just don't know what's natural, what's not natural in that. But if you've not had breakfast, and if you had an early supper, you've gone for more than 24 hours without carbohydrate in your digestive system. And probably most of the glycogen stores you've had in your liver, especially your liver, are gone now. Well, where does the glucose come from that your brain's using right now if your glycogen's gone, if your storage form of glucose is gone? Well, this comes from here. It comes from gluconeogenesis in the liver. Well, okay, that's fine. Where does the pyruvate come from? Well, the pyruvate comes from simple amino acids. If you recall the structure of pyruvate, Pyruvate looks like that. All this is, if we change this, if we add ammonia to this in the right position, okay, so there's an NH2 here. I'm going to put a plus sign right there, make it an NH3, and make this a negative sign. That's actually the correct form of it. It's physiological pH. And also do me a favor here and remove this hydrogen. So what I'm doing on the board is I'm drawing a pyruvate and an amino acid. Can someone tell me what this amino acid is? Here's the three atom backbone, nitrogen, carbon, and the carboxylic acid. Here's the side chain, CH3. Remember what the CH3 side chain was? Alanine. Exactly correct. So, alanine is a very common precursor for pyruvate, which then is used here. So when you have not had breakfast and your brain needs glucose, you begin to consume amino acids. And that's typically not a problem. If you're reasonably healthy, especially in the United States, your blood has plenty of protein in it in the form of albumin. It gets broken down. And one of the most common things that gets broken down is alanine, and in a single step it gets made in pyruvate. Pyruvate then goes into gluconeogenesis, and bingo, you got glucose that gets dumped back into the blood from the liver, and your brain's just fine. Okay, so it's an important intermediate mechanism. I just wanted to remind you of that. The next one here is the next enzyme in gluconeogenesis, starting from the bottom up, is PEPCK, phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. Phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. It's, again, fairly highly regulated. It uses a lot of energy, and you add a carbon dioxide, then you lose a carbon dioxide to make phosphoenolpyruvate. Phosphoenolpyruvate, as you remember, is the highest energy highest energy carbohydrate in the body, PEP, the highest energy. Lots of PEP with phosphoenolpyruvate. It then reversibly goes up the glycolytic pathway. It's amazing that some of these things are reversible. Here you have NADH being formed here, ATP. It's reversible. Then it gets to fructose bisphosphatase. It avoids that particular regulatory spot, goes up here, glucose 6-phosphatase, and makes glucose, and then that gets dumped out into the blood. I'd like you to circle glucose 6-phosphatase, if you don't mind, and make the note, does not exist in muscle tissue. Does not exist in muscle tissue. So muscle tissue cannot directly dump glucose into the blood, even though glycogen exists in a fairly high concentration in muscle tissue. Glycogen exists primarily in liver and muscle tissue, but the energy buffer that your blood needs is almost coming exclusively from the liver. Muscle can dump energy equivalents into the blood. They do so primarily by dumping in gluten and alanine, but muscles do not dump glucose into the blood because they're missing that enzyme. All right, now let's go on and take a look at the TCA cycle. Again, energetic consequence, TCA. One acetate through the cycle produces two carbon dioxides, one ATP, and four reduced coenzymes. Now, what are the four reduced coenzymes? There's three NADHs that it produces, and what else is the, what's the fourth one? What's the fourth one? Three NADHs and one FADH2. That's absolutely correct. Now, carbon atoms of acetyl have different fates in the TCA cycle. Let's see here. What this particular slide is saying is that as an acetyl group enters into the pathway, it is not immediately lost as carbon dioxide. Previous carbons that have entered are lost. For example here, you do not need to memorize this. Okay, don't memorize this. I simply want you to understand the concept that the carbon dioxides that are being lost at any given instant in the citric acid cycle came from acetyl-CoA from the previous cycle. Okay, so here's the idea. The first labeled carbon dioxide, label that black dot, the first two carbon comes in, it lands here and follows through. And if you notice here, two important ideas right here at the bottom. One, as that labeled carbon comes in, and the carbon dioxide leaves, the carbon dioxide that's leaving is not a part of the newly added acetyl-CoA. It comes from the newly added acetyl-CoA. It came from previous turns of the citric acid cycle. It gets to succinate and fumarate, and the label gets mixed. In other words, because succinate and fumarate are stereochemically racemic, they're a mesostructure, then they can be flipped back and forth in the enzyme, and you may have had 100% at this particular label, but following succinate and fumarate, you get 50% at one end and 50% at the other. So the label gets mixed at succinate and fumarate. You then follow that around, and what happens is you take this over here, and then the second round, after it's gotten flipped, that's when the carbon dioxide leaves that you originally entered in the first cycle. So the second cycle of any given point is the second round is where the acetyl-CoA carbons are lost. Does that make sense? Any questions about this? Yes. Well, if you see here, there are four carbons, one, two, three, four here. And the first time this acetyl-CoA comes in, if this is the only place that that carbon is labeled, that is the only place that carbon 13 is. Okay, the other three carbons are unlabeled, and this carbon here is completely labeled. When we move to succinate, the molecule is symmetrical. And therefore, hold up your hand like this. If this is the enzyme, and this is a substrate, okay? Now, it's, my obviously my little finger and big thumb are not symmetrical, but if the label here is at the top the first time it comes through, okay? But this is symmetrical, so it can go in and sit on the enzyme like this, or it can go in and sit in the enzyme like this. Okay, and that means either the half the label is going to be on this carbon, and the other half is going to be on this carbon. So it distributes the labeling among the two ends of fumarate. So fumarate can be labeled half of it at the top, half at the bottom, because of the symmetrical nature of succinyl-CoA. Does that make sense? Okay, pardon me. All right, so, but that's not when you lose it on the second round. All right, well, you can skip this. This is just, it gets increasingly ridiculous, but because you've got the same, you got the idea. This is the label of the carbonyl group of the acetate that's coming in, and this is the label for the methyl group of the acetate that's coming in, and it gets very confused. I mean, it barely loses anything. So this is half of half of half of half. You will not need to memorize this. You will not need to memorize this either, except to know the conceptual idea of what's going on in the citric acid cycle. All right. Can the TCH provide intermediates? Absolutely. We've gone through this. This is a more complicated diagram from the previous one that you saw. You will not need to memorize this one either, but it does provide some additional understanding. For example, oxaloacetate, of course, as you know, can be made into phosphoenolpyruvate and then made into carbohydrates. Fatty acids can enter into acetyl-CoA and also be made from acetyl-CoA. Acetyl-CoA goes through and makes steroids. The citric acid cycle is responsible for purines, for porphyrins, for pyrimidines and other amino acids. So this citric acid cycle is like the Piccadilly Circus of the body, of the metabolic pathways. Anybody ever been to England? Anybody here been to England? Did you ever go to London and see Piccadilly Circus? Describe what Piccadilly Circus is.
When you go, you see, it's kind of like in a circle. Uh-huh. And when you go around, it just has all these different various buildings.
Mm-hmm. And streets. How many streets do you think come into that?
A lot,
yeah. Piccadilly Circus is basically, you know, these round, what they call roundabouts that we have in front of the Howard. Only instead of having, let's see here, one, two, three, they have seven, maybe eight streets coming in at the same time. And so you come in one and you go all the way around to come out the other. And so there's cars constantly coming in and leaving. And it's just a circus. That's why they call it a circus. It's just complete chaos. They try to make it controlled, but of course it isn't. And this is a Piccadilly Circus. You've got things coming in, you've got things coming out. Welcome to the citric acid cycle. Now, don't worry. Let's see here. Okay. Don't worry. Oh, yes. Mitochondrial citrate. In other words, that you see this citric acid right here once it's formed. This citrate, where is all this occurring? Where is this cycle actually located? In the mitochondria? Well, all these things end up having to be exported somewhere. I mean, because the mitochondria doesn't need all this stuff. The pyrimidines and purines, they all obviously have to get to the nucleus, although there are some DNA in the mitochondria. So these carbons that are generated, and many of these things are exported, and there are specific proteins that are export proteins for many of them. The unique thing about citrate is that it's such a common thing. The mitochondrial citrate can be exported to a cytoplasmic to be a cytoplasmic source of acetyl-CoA and oxaloacetate. This is because fatty acid synthesis occurs in the cytosol. So go back here and do me a favor and simply circle this and say cytosol. This is occurring in the cytosol. The citric acid that's made, or acetyl-CoA, eventually gets exported and gets made into fatty acids. That gets made into acetyl-CoA and oxaloacetate, which are used for synthesis of fatty acids. Now, how do you get that citrate out there? How do you get that citrate out of there? Do you remember? Let me go back here. All right. I got to show you this from first semester. Do you remember phosphofructokinase? One of the small molecules that regulated phosphofructokinase. That's this thing right here, right at the very top of the glycolytic pathway. One of the small molecules that regulated it was citrate. Citrate. It was an inhibitor. Phosphofructokinase was inhibited by citrate. Well, how in the world could that happen? Well, this is exactly what happens is that the citrate is exported into the cytosol. And that affects the metabolic activity of the glycolytic pathway there. So excess citrate, which means that the cell has plenty of energy, will slow down glycolysis. So this is how citrate gets exported. Let's see here. Here we go. So, here's the mitochondria. Doing. Here is the cytosol. Got that? Mitochondria, cytosol. And we start down here with citrate. We can start down here with citrate. Notice pyruvate from glycolysis is imported. Maybe even acetyl-CoA is here. It comes in, oxaloacetate, then gets made into citrate. Citrate has a specific transporter. It gets shifted into the cytosol. The cytosol then breaks down the citrate into oxaloacetate and acetyl-CoA. Acetyl-CoA goes on and does its own business. The malate then is recycled back into the mitochondria and executed again. And then the citrate is then brought out. So there's all kinds of things going on in which there's a citrate-malate shuttle. So if you don't mind, write that phrase down here somewhere. Citrate-malate shuttle. Citrate-malate shuttle. And then circle this sentence right here. This is the citrate-malate shuttle. This cycle provides acetyl-CoA for fatty acid synthesis in the cytosol. Right? The citrate regulates glycolysis, but it provides also carbon units for making fats. Let's see here. Oh, anaplerotic. Can you guys say anaplerotic? Say anaplerotic.
Anaplerotic.
There you go. Anna Green Gables. Never mind. At any rate, these are filling up. Remember I said the PEB carboxylase converts pyruvate into oxaloacetate, PEP to oxaloacetate. Pyruvate carboxylase converts pyruvate to oxaloacetate. And malic enzyme converts pyruvate into malate. The one I'm most concerned about for you, these are important. The pyruvate carboxylase is the most important to me. The malate we may get a hold of a little later, but it's a pyruvate carboxylase. And what it says down here, so it's bullet point number 2 and bullet point number 4, which are related. Pyruvate carboxylase can remove. Well, no, wait a minute. No, they're not. That's actually not the same thing. Pyruvate carboxy kinase. Yeah. Okay. It basically is the pyruvate carboxylase and PEB carboxykinase that we talked about. So this one is a reversible reaction, but it could have been an anaplaric reaction, which we're talking about here. It actually isn't, but it is used in gluconeogenesis. So the key one here for me is that pyruvate carboxylase and this little note about pyruvate PEP carboxykinase. I'm not so worried about... This is a fairly confusing diagram. We can skip this one. Just write skip across that, please. Skip. And you can skip this particular reaction. All right. But I do, yeah, you can skip this particular reaction as well. You do need to know what PEPCK is and what it's used for. Right? You do need to know what it is and what it's used for, but to actually memorize the reaction, don't worry about it. How is it regulated? Three reactions at key sites, citrate synthase, isocitrate dehydrogenase, alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase. Just underline those as regulatory points. The specific nature of that we will discuss a little bit later. You don't need to just underline citrate synthase, isocitrate dehydrogenase, alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase. The specifics that follow this I have given you in table form a little later, so don't worry about it. Now, so up here you can see where pyruvate dehydrogenase is highly regulated. It's inhibited by acetyl-CoA, NADH, and ATP. It's stimulated by NAD and CoA, and citrate synthase is inhibited by ATP, NADH, and succinyl-CoA. You can see these specific points of regulation. I don't want you to memorize how they're regulated. I just want you to know which enzymes do the regulation. Citrate synthase, isocitrate dehydrogenase, alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase, and obviously pyruvate dehydrogenase. So there's four of them. Those are the regulatory enzymes in the citric acid cycle. How they're regulated, we just don't have time to make you know. So now, different subject, slightly different subject. It's related to the citric acid cycle. It's related to the citric acid cycle. The purpose of the citric acid cycle is to maximize energy capture from glucose. All right? It's to maximize energy capture from glucose. It captures the energy as ATP, NADH, and FADH2. Of course, we know what the fate of ATP is, and we will talk today about the fate of NADH and FADH2. But is that the only thing that can be used for? No. The citric acid cycle has other roles to play. And one of the most important roles is something that you can't do. Okay. You can, as because we're Americans and we have the most outstanding agricultural resources in the world, we are among the first time in human history a country whose general population is overweight. And we shouldn't be all that unhappy about it, okay? Not even in the height of Rome, with all of its power and prestige and wealth, was the population overweight, the general population overweight. Food has become that inexpensive in the United States. In India, you can easily spend 70% of your daily income on food. In the United States, we say 15%. That's why you can buy an iPod. Okay? That's why we can buy an iPod. But be that as it may, one of the interesting physiological quirks is that you cannot change fat into glucose. You do not have the enzymes to change fat into glucose. Once fat is on you, the only way you can get rid of it is to use it for energy. It's not going to make glucose. If your brain needs glucose, and you're using gluconeogenesis, it's not going to come from fat. It's only going to come from 3 carbon units or higher. That means amino acids. So, but Seeds, however, are different. Seeds are spaceships that the plant sends off into an unknown environment. And therefore, seeds have to have the most compact form of building blocks, that is carbon, that's possible. And that means the carbon is in its most reduced form. That means the carbon is in the form of fat or oil. So oil, fat, primarily oil, is a very compact way of carrying carbons around. But you can't make any kind of structural features out of fat. Okay? You can make structural features out of glucose because that can make cellulose. And cellulose will make the plant structure. So how do you get from the fat that the seed has into the glucose that the seed needs to make cellulose to pierce through a layer of soil? As you know, this is soil right here, and the seed is right there, and warmth and moisture stimulate the nascent life that's in there, and it begins to produce a little cotyledon. Now, this cotyledon is just white as can be. There's no sunlight underground. It's primarily made out of cellulose. And it's trying to get to the surface where it can start doing photosynthesis. So where do the carbons for that cotyledon come from, for that seed? Well, it comes from lipid or oil. So where do you get corn oil from? Crushing the plant or crushing the seeds? Where do you get soybean oil from? The seeds. Where do you get canola oil from? The seeds. I mean, this is all from the seeds. The plant itself does not have the oil. Because the oil is the compound that's storing the carbons, that's converted into carbohydrate, that makes the cotyledon, that causes it to grow up and push up through the soil, and as soon as it hits sunlight, it turns green and photosynthesis takes over. This is why you can bury a seed too deep. The seed will grow the cotyledon, but it will not have enough carbon in it to pierce the surface of the soil. Okay. You can bury it too shallow, and what happens is there, it typically dries out before it can even begin to grow. Or there's not enough moisture there, or it's too hot or something. All right, so acetate, that's lipids, growth, net sinks the carbohydrate and other lipids from acetate. So acetate-based growth, which is the net synthesis of glucose from fats and lipids. This is using the glyoxylate cycle. Offers a solution for plants, that's seeds, and some bacteria and algae. The CO2 evolving steps are bypassed and extra acetate is utilized. Isocitrate lyase, malate synthase, so the short-circuiting enzymes. Let's take a look. Now, what did I say? Can we make glucose from oxaloacetate? Can we make glucose from oxaloacetate? What's right here? Gets made into phosphoenol, which then goes what? So if we have oxaloacetate, can we make glucose? That's a yes. Okay, good. All right, there we go. So if we could have, but notice if you, well, the acetyl-CoA and point an arrow here and say from lipids. The acetyl-CoA comes from the lipids. The acetyl-CoA combines with oxaloacetate, comes down here to make citrate, comes down here to make isocitrate. But if this pathway continued on to alpha-ketoglutarate, what would we lose here? A carbon dioxide. Now, that would be foolish for a seed to lose carbon dioxide because it's not doing photosynthesis. It's still underground in the dark. So how does it avoid losing that carbon dioxide? It doesn't go that direction. isocitrate then has a unique enzyme in the glyoxylate cycle called isocitrate lyase. It gets broken down into succinate and glyoxylate. Well, that gets made into fumarate. The glyoxylate is combined again with another acetyl-CoA. Where do you think this acetyl-CoA is coming from? Say lipid, same place. Fatty acid breakdown. And so you now have four carbons here and four carbons here, and you make two malates. All right? I think that's what happens here. No. I'm sorry. Makes a four-carbon malate here, and fumarate gets made into malate. And so you end up then with an acetyl-CoA coming in here and acetyl-CoA coming in here. You end up making an excess oxaloacetate. And so point off from the oxaloacetate and say glucose. And from glucose, then point to another line and say cellulose. So glucose then is production. So the cellulose is produced from the glucose, which is produced from the excess oxaloacetate, which is made by the glyoxylate cycle. The result is that one turn of the cycle consumes one oxaloacetate and two acetyl-CoA molecules, produces two molecules of oxaloacetate. The net for this cycle is one oxaloacetate from two acetyl-CoA molecules. And that oxaloacetate goes on to make a what? Glucose, which then goes on to make what? Which then goes on to make the cotyledon, which then grows up through the soil and begins to do what? Photosynthesis. And then that's done. Now, it takes two. Now, do you need to memorize this cycle? I need for you to know the purpose of isocitrate lyase and malate synthase. The cycle itself is irrelevant, but I need for you to know that the glyoxylate cycle has two unique enzymes from the citric acid cycle, isocitrate lyase and malate synthase. And the overall role, it takes two acetyl-CoAs to make an excess oxaloacetate, which then goes on to make glucose, which then goes on to make cellulose. So here you see, here's the glyoxysome. Here comes as free as fatty acids. It combines with oxaloacetate, makes citrate, isocitrate, makes glyoxylate and succinate. Glyoxylate and acetyl-CoA then go on to make malate and then go on to make carbohydrate. The succinate comes back, gets transported over the mitochondria, gets reformed back into oxaloacetate, and starts that cycle again. But notice, do you see any loss of carbon dioxide? No. And therefore, two of these come in and make one oxaloacetate, which then does lose the carbon dioxide to make a three-carbon unit. Two of those threes end up making glucose, and bingo, you're off and running. Now, then we're going to change directions again, just a little bit, just to give you a little background on electrochemistry. Basically, what's happening with all the production of the FADH2 and the NADH is we're shifting electrons around from highly reduced to more oxidized. Highly reduced to more oxidized. That's how we get energy in our planet. The fact that we have an oxygen atmosphere, which evolutionary biologists can't really explain where we get the oxygen from. And and so it's the exchange of electrons, which we're going to look at here in just a little bit, that allows us to extract energy out of all these different compounds. Okay, so we just need to go through a quick review of this. Processes, so oxidation reactions are the processes involving the transfer of electrons. In photosynthesis, carbon dioxide is reduced while water is oxidized. So I'm talking a little bit about photosynthesis. And so what that means is that we do the opposite of that. We reduce oxygen and oxidize carbon. That's how we get our energy out of it. And the plants are doing just the exact opposite. Plant reduces carbon dioxide and oxidizes water. It's hard to believe that a plant can oxidize water, but it can. It's truly a miracle. The Nernst equation will help us quantify that transfer. We'll be looking at that. Electron donor is a reducing agent, which is oxidized itself. The electron acceptor, of course, is an oxidizing agent because it itself is reduced. So you have Fe3, copper 1, Fe2, copper 2. So in this thing, which one is reduced here? Which of these two ions is reduced, iron or copper? Which one gains electrons? The iron does. So iron has been reduced and can be called the oxidizing agent. Which one is then oxidized? Copper. Did you ever hear the term Leo the lion says grr? Leo the lion says grr. Have you heard that before? Leo. If you have trouble remembering this, it's pretty easy actually. Leo the lion says grr. All right. Loss of electrons is oxidation. Gain of electrons is reduction. Leo the lion says grr. Sorry, it's simple-minded, but those are the best things to remember sometimes. So here you have electrochemical cell. Electrons are dumped onto the iron. They come from the copper. There is an activity difference between copper and iron ions, and that activity difference is captured as voltage between these two platinum electrodes. The salt bridge is designed there to keep electrochemical and charge balance. The Nernst equation is really very straightforward. But first of all, we need to take a look at the free energy of oxidation related, like put the delta G, the free energy of any electrochemical reaction is, of course, equal to this equation where N is the number of electrons being transferred at a time. F is the Faraday constant, and I'll have to give you the actual value of the Faraday constant. I think it's 96,282 joules per mole or something like that. And the delta E is the change in voltage between the two, between the oxidizing and reducing, oxidized and reducing form, reduced form. The Nernst equation extends this. The Nernst equation actually gives us an idea of what the voltage is. And here you have the standard voltage, which is found on a table, the change in voltage due to the actual concentration of the reactants at any given instant. Of course, the log of that, the gas constant in Faraday's, I think, temperature in Kelvin, number of electrons, and again, that Faraday constant right there. And we do the delta E. The delta E, if it's not some variable concentration, if you're dealing with standard states, the standard state is really pretty simple. The change in voltage is simply the voltage of the electron acceptor minus the voltage of the electron donor. That would be delta E in a standard state situation. Sometimes you can just go ahead and use that up here, especially on a problem that I'm going to show you next. Standard reduction potential for some biochemically important half reactions. These actually are experimental values that have been determined by research scientists under standard state conditions. Here you have the situation where you've got the most highly oxidized voltage here is where oxygen captures two electrons to make water, and that's got an enormous oxidative potential, a negative 8.15. Fumarate can gain two electrons to make succinate, and here you have a voltage of 0.031. And so if you can take these electrons and move them from here to water, you can extract that much voltage between the two reactions and extract energy out of that difference. So all these kinds of oxidation reductions of these very common compounds, either in the electron transport system or in the TCA cycle, when you compare it to oxygen and its high oxidation voltage, you can extract energy of the difference between that. So basically, oxygen becomes an electron dump. Electron dump. Electrons are extracted out of carbons, are extracted out of fats and carbohydrates and stuff, and they're dumped onto oxygen. And that energy difference between the reduction of the reduced voltages of the carbohydrate and lipid and what oxygen is, that difference right there you can extract out as energy. You could actually have compounds that are so highly reduced that as you exchange electrons, the voltage is actually negative. And so here you have a high energy compound such as acetate and going acetaldehyde. You can see that there's a large reduction potential there. And if you take the difference between this electron right here and if it, you can dump it directly onto oxygen, you're going to get a lot of energy out of that. A lot of energy out of that. Now, what I'm going to do is calculate standard free energy change to the following redox reactions. I'm going to write this up for you as an example. We just don't have time today. I have another 5 minutes in class. Is that correct? Is that what you have? I'm not prepared really to do this. I will be prepared on Monday to demonstrate that particular process for you. And then I'll give you a couple simple homework problems to just to practice using this very simple equations, this equation and this equation down here. Probably won't be doing too much with the Nernst equation itself. All right, so is that the end of that for the citric acid cycle? It is. Now, I have a handout for you. This is, everything's on D2L right now. I don't have the audio parts of the lecture set up yet, but well, here, you can just pass it around. This is the next section. It turns out to be a Word document, which is okay. And so then I also have, if I give this chapter 21 to you, would you lose it, or should I give it to you later? Here's chapter 21. So you now have chapter 19, chapter 20, and chapter 21. We haven't started on chapter 20 lecture yet. Now, the important thing with the citric acid cycle, of course, is the production of NADH and FADH2. These are highly reduced compounds that you can extract energy out of. But, of course, notice I said you can extract energy out of them. How do you do it? How do you extract that energy out of them? Well, that's the purpose of the electron transport system, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Moving materials, and in this particular, this is the first and last outline you're going to get like this. But at any rate, we're going to be talking about the moving materials in and out of the mitochondrial membrane, thermodynamics of electron transport, coupling, control of ATP synthesis. If you can strike out the these states of the mitochondria. I deleted that because we're going to run into time issues. As you can tell, we're supposed to be done with this lecture today. All right. Whoops. It jumps around. And okay. So, if you notice, you have a few blanks that you need to fill in there. And I've got 2 minutes. We're going to get today's page done. Now, moving materials in and out of the inner mitochondrial membrane. The outer mitochondrial membrane is permeable to virtually everything but hydrogen ions. Okay? Permeable to everything except hydrogen ions. It's the inner mitochondrial membrane that's just the opposite. It's impermeable to virtually everything. The inner mitochondrial membrane is basically a wall about 12 feet thick that nothing can get through unless it has its own transporter. All right? And so everything that enters and leaves requires a transporter, maybe even water. Aquaporins is what they're talking about. Here is just a very simple list of the transporters. Notice this says cytosol, this says mitochondria, this says inner mitochondrial membrane, which means that I'm not even worried about the outer mitochondrial membrane. It's impermeable to all. It's permeable to all this. It doesn't even matter. So here you can see you got the monocarboxylate transport. You got pyruvate going in, hydroxide phosphate going in, malate coming out, malate going in, citrate coming out. We've already talked about that. Phosphate going in, hydroxide going out, ADP going in, ATP coming out. But notice the ADP and ATP are different charges. So how do you keep the mitochondria from becoming positively charged or negatively charged? Well, you have these other transporters that move charges around. Here you've got this malate alpha-ketoglutarate transporter. I think we talked a little bit about that even. Note the following transporters. You got the monocarboxylate pyruvate from glycolysis enters mitochondria, tricarboxylate, the citrate for fat biosynthesis leaves the mitochondria, adenine nucleotide, ATP generated by ATP synthase leaves mito. All right. Now, the question of the day is, with all the NADH that's produced by the by glycolysis, and you do recall that it is produced by glycolysis, is that correct? NADH is produced by glycolysis? Yes. Okay, good. How does that get into the mitochondria so it can be used in the production of ATP? Let's see here. No, there we go. Oop. How this does, the NADH that's produced in glycolysis, and perhaps you should underline NADH and say from glycolysis, because we get NADH from citric acid cycle, but this is the NADH from glycolysis, enters into the matrix. Da 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 da. The one. Enter the matrix of mitochondria by the malate aspartate shuttle or the alpha-glycerol phosphate shuttle. How do the reducing units from glycolysis get into the mitochondria? And we will discover that mystery on Monday.
I just want to let you know that da 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 is from the Twilight Zone album.